generations, people have been coming here to Kislovodsk to get healthy, taking advantage of the mineral waters and the fresh air. Today, the city is at the forefront of cutting-edge research, helping athletes, not by utilizing that air, but by depriving them from it. Today, we are speaking to the head of the Innovation Center of the Russian Olympic Committee, world-renowned trainer, Alexander Grushin. You have trained 15 Olympic champions, 24 world champions.
Training in a hypoxic environment can enhance general performance. What we've proposed is using artificial hypoxia in this environment.
What does lack of oxygen actually do to a person's body?
It's a controversial topic. Mm-hmm. It's all individual. There are many factors at play here. The level of hypoxia, its duration. This equipment essentially allows us to put the athlete at an altitude of up to 6,000 meters above sea level. An athlete chooses to train with us. That means increasing their training load and using advanced techniques to improve performance, set new records.
Alexander, thank you for taking the time to meet us today. You know what you're doing when it comes to training world athletes. You have trained 15 Olympic champions, 24 world champions. So what made you think about using hypoxia as a training mechanism?
Traditional approaches to training. I wouldn't say they've become obsolete, but they are common knowledge. Variations mostly recombine elements to find optimal low and high intensity training, and that's a role for coaches. So experts increasingly try to enrich the process with non-traditional methods. There are many ways, actually. They range from using special equipment to building new facilities. Among the well-known, hypoxic training is particularly interesting. It gained popularity in the last 30 years or so. It began when people realized that competitions are not always at the same altitude. Many high-profile international events take place way above sea level. For example, the Olympic Games in Mexico were held at over 2,000 meters above sea level. Obviously, you need special training to perform in those conditions. Also, training in a hypoxic environment can enhance general performance.
So when I think of hypoxia, I think of shortness of breath, confusion, and possibly, well, all of the negative effects. What does lack of oxygen actually do to a person's body, and how can it help your athletes?
A lack of oxygen in the air has a range of effects on the human body. First, it triggers an adaptation response that improves the efficiency of our oxygen transport system. It improves circulation, increases oxygen uptake in our muscles, and that means a greater capacity for generating energy. As I said, hypoxic training serves multiple purposes. First, it prepares athletes for high-altitude competitions. Second, it improves an athlete's capabilities. It also helps determine whether a person is genetically fit to perform in hypoxic conditions. Hypoxic training can be introduced at an early stage, during pre-season training, to help the athlete optimize movement and reach new skill levels. So we're essentially accelerating the training process.
So your athletes, when you're here in Kislovodsk, are already training at a certain altitude. What does that do to their bodies? How do they adapt to this altitude right here?
Mm-hmm. The Kislovodsk Training Center is 1,240 meters above sea level. For some sports, especially cycling, that's not enough. I hope we can find methods to increase the effectiveness of altitude training for our athletes. As I said, the results speed up the training process and make it more effective. Naturally, all training is aimed at improving performance, and that's what it does.
So athletes say that they, when they train at high altitudes for a long time, that they start to lose effectiveness. They can't train for as long. Does that mean that you can only be at a certain altitude for so long and then you have to return to sea level and then train normally? Is there some sort of an alternation that needs to happen?
We know that the optimal length of a single stay at high altitude is between 10 and 24 days. After that, the athlete must recover before training at altitude again. If we're talking about effectiveness, the best or most rational is around 90 days at high altitude. We have experience in this area. But it all varies from athlete to athlete. For some, that works. But there's an average to these parameters.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate just a little bit here. High altitude training has been around for a long time, as well as live high, train low. What is innovative about what you're doing, and how is it different from old practices?
Let's talk about this particular case first. We're currently at an altitude of 1,200 meters, which isn't very high. Sports research shows the best conditions are to live at around 1,800 to 2,100 meters above sea level, with training at 1,100 to 1,200 meters above sea level. But you obviously need to commute between your living quarters and the training ground, so you lose time. What we've proposed is using artificial hypoxia in this environment. We have a lot of equipment for creating conditions, and this increases our training capabilities. Training efficiency skyrockets when the sports camp simulates the higher altitude, and then outdoor training takes place at a lower level. We're able to create this higher altitude at the camp without pressure sealing, so there are lots of opportunities here.
There are countries like Kenya that the athletes naturally train at higher elevations. Does that mean that they are genetically already able to adapt to this? And can you train athletes to be as good as them?
In terms of research, there are two contradicting views on this matter. Those who study the training process itself agree that the efficiency is really high, almost unilaterally. Those who study physiology or similar don't completely discard the idea, but argue that a professional setup at sea level could yield the same results. So it's a controversial topic. Both views make strong points, but I can give you an example. You know the home village of Martinfourcade in France? I've been there. 11 Olympic champions come from that little settlement. Is it good or bad? Is it genetic predisposition? It's definitely food for thought. 11 Olympic champions were born and raised there. To me, that looks like a good answer to your question.
Now, I guess what I really want to ask is, what are your athletes experiencing when they are going through hypoxia training?
Any athlete doing higher altitude training goes through certain phases. The training process must account for stages of acclimatization. This is also true for the opposite process, reacclimatization to sea level. The trainer must build a program taking this into consideration, and there are lots of variables. For example, how often has the athlete been to a mountainous area, as this could change the program a lot? How well does he or she tolerate hypoxia? That's important as well. So it's all individual. You need to know the athlete to come up with a good program. High altitude training may also have different objectives. If the goal is to improve strength, 10 to 11 days is enough. But if it's about endurance, it's better to stay for longer, 21 to 24 days. This is the foundation upon which to build the micro cycles of an efficient training program. You should always keep your training goals and objectives in mind.
Shall we continue the conversation inside the training center? So you have an impressive center here. I see that you have equipment for different sports. What kind of athletes need this type of training the most? Is it swimmers, skaters, skiers, or is it generalized for all athletes?
First of all, it's not just about training. We can test the athlete's capabilities here. Until recently, endurance sports were considered to benefit from hypoxia training the most. But it's been proven that this kind of training is also good for strength, speed, and coordination sports. It's just the techniques that differ. But the concept has demonstrated its feasibility for improving performance in almost all athletic disciplines.
Does every single athlete have their own limits on what they can handle, or is it a one-size-fits-all kind of a process when it comes to hypoxia training?
It all depends on the goals the trainer sets. It also depends on how the program is scheduled, either during preparation or an active competition. There are many factors at play here. The level of hypoxia, its duration. Again, it all depends on the goals of the trainers and athletes.
I know that hypoxia can actually be dangerous. It can kill. For example, if you're on Mount Everest, you can't be up there without oxygen for a long time. How do you make sure that you protect these athletes from the dangers of hypoxia?
The World Health Organization has guidelines, and then our own experience over the years. Typically, this is how it looks. Training in a hypoxic environment is mitigated by the oxygen level in the air. It's recommended that your blood oxygen saturation level, which is directly correlated to the level of oxygen in the air, is no less than 80%. Going lower than that is not advisable. Speaking of oxygen concentration in the air, it depends on the altitude. Under the guidelines, it's not recommended to go above 3,000 meters. The highest recommended elevation is 2,500 meters above sea level.
Now, I see you have some different equipment. I see some masks. Can you tell me what this equipment is and maybe show me how it works?
There is a multitude of equipment here. We have facilities that measure various aspects of an athlete's functional performance. For example, to measure aerobic performance. Over there, the man in the mask, we perform gas exchange analysis. With an athlete under pressure, we observe indicators such as maximum oxygen consumption, the anaerobic supply threshold, and so on. Based on these observations, we structure the training process and adjust its intensity. Other equipment is designed to measure a host of properties. For example, we have equipment for measuring strength potential. There are specific parameters we look into, and the equipment measures potential and functional fitness.
Let's see what else you can show me. This looks like an incredibly interesting room right here. My understanding is that the runner inside can get the experience of being on top of Mount Elbrus and really fast. What's actually happening in this room?
This is where a special gas mixture is administered for athletes to breathe in. The mixture contains a set percentage of oxygen. Depending on target altitude, the percentage of oxygen is altered. This equipment essentially allows us to put the athlete at an altitude of up to 6,000 meters above sea level. As I mentioned earlier, we have trained mountain climbers using this equipment. This is where people are trained to climb Mount Elbrus or other higher peaks. The equipment allows them to better prepare for it.
So you can actually measure their intake and you can control the atmosphere where they are. Can you show me a little bit how that works?
Oxygen levels are monitored on a special dashboard. It shows us the percentage of oxygen in the mixture. Everything is automated.
So you have been a good sport. You've been working out for us. Tell me, how do you feel after all of this with all of this equipment?
I feel good after this training session. This type of training helps me improve and regulate my training process and to achieve better results.
So it seems to me balance is very important. Is it all about the physical training and getting the body ready for the sport, or is there a mental aspect to getting these athletes ready as well?
I'd like to show you one more thing before I answer that question. We have a unique piece of equipment that you won't find anywhere else in the world. This is a roller ski treadmill for professional skiers, biathletes, and Nordic combined athletes. It also uses a hypoxic environment, which allows us to train athletes at up to 3,000 meters. As for your question about the relationship between the physical conditioning and mental performance, there are two aspects to consider. First, hypoxia certainly affects mental ability, but unfortunately, this subject is underexplored. Basically, testing mental capacity requires a certain amount of stress. Hypoxia also causes stress, as do various health conditions. Hypoxia is involved in all of these stressful influences, but the exact effect on the body is uncertain. We can say with confidence that if the intensity of hypoxic exposure is very high, that is, above certain limits, this leads to fairly unpleasant conditions, which can ultimately damage and destroy brain cells. However, moderate hypoxic exposure has a positive effect. Unfortunately, no one has the precise data on the correlation between physical and mental states under such conditions.
It seems trust should also be important. Trust the athlete in themselves, trust between the trainer and the athlete, especially when you have a non-conventional training method like hypoxia. How do you get the athlete to trust you?
An athlete chooses to train with us. That means increasing their training load and using advanced techniques to improve performance, set new records, and so on. Hypoxia is not a completely new concept. It's been around for a long time. There are specific methods involved. Coaches of the highest caliber have proved that these produce a positive effect. When athletes are offered the chance to try them, they recognize how effective these methods are. There's no need to persuade them, really. In any case, we can say with certainty that this approach has a positive impact on an athlete's performance.
You're one of the best trainers in the world. With all of your experience, what do you think is the most important and most difficult, getting an athlete ready, mentally prepared, or physically prepared?
It's hard to give an exact ratio, as it all depends on the sport. Everyone requires a different combination of physical conditions. It's very specific on a case-by-case basis. Sometimes it's physical power that's key, or good coordination, or mental capacity. It all depends on the sport.
Now, what I've seen so far has been incredibly impressive. I know that you have plans for a specific hypoxia center. Tell me more about that, and what do you see for the future of this program here in Russia?
Today, we're considering a project in Kislovodsk, where the training base is at an altitude of 1,200 meters above sea level. We've been developing new equipment. If we upgrade the residential quarters at Kislovodsk, we could get a combination of artificial and natural hypoxia. This would allow us to combine different technologies and ratios of artificial and natural hypoxia in the training process for athletes in Kislovodsk. There are very few bases like this today.
Alexander Grushin, it has been an incredibly interesting conversation. Thank you for taking the time to show us around your facility. Wish you luck in the future.
So we know that hypoxic training can prove to be beneficial for professional athletes, but can it be adapted to treat illnesses as well?
As it turns out, here at the Orjonikidze Health Resort back in Kislovodsk, hypoxia therapy is being used, and we wanted to find out more about its practical applications.
Thank you very much for having us here. It's a very interesting place. My first question, I guess, is here in Kislovodsk, the air is very clean, but many of us live in cities that are heavily polluted, have exhaust fumes. In a sense, aren't we already being deprived of oxygen? How is hypoxia different?
Hypoxia doesn't improve the condition of a person who is exposed to exhaust fumes, polluted air, etc. More oxygen would be better in this case. In Kislovodsk, the air is clean. There are no fumes here. The facility we're in right now is 920 meters above sea level. By default, it has less oxygen than other places at sea level, large cities, for example. To counter the effects of polluted air, you need more oxygen.
So our team this week, we were up on Mount Elbrus. And earlier, I've been on Kilimanjaro as well as to Mount Everest Base Camp. So I've experienced hypoxia firsthand. And what I can tell you is it can play tricks on your brain a little bit. So I'm now being told that hypoxia can be good for your brain. How is that?
It's not an easy question to answer. It can be explained by the way our bodies self-regulate. There is adaptation and reaction to changes in the environment. The reactions are unlimited. If you reached an altitude of 4,500 meters, like Mount Kilimanjaro, your body constantly suffers from stress hypoxia. Adaptation can take some time. Initially, it takes 7 days, and full adaptation can take 2 to 3 months. When you enter a different environment, your body slowly adjusts to the changes around you. When you're high up in the mountains, suffering from the chronic stress of hypoxia, your body can break down because you're using up your internal reserves. When we treat people here, we do that without subjecting them to hyperstress, when your body is pushed to function in an entirely different mode. However, after you spend 7 to 10 days in a state of low hypoxia, when you go back to a big city like Moscow or St. Petersburg, located at sea level, your body has this incredible feeling, as if it is saying, wow, this is how it should be. And that's when you can unlock its potential. Adaptation is key to treatment and how patients respond to it. You change your environment. You subject your body to stress, pushing it towards new systems, new regulations, and new perceptions. In the end, it all comes down to dopamine levels, dopamine being the feel-good hormone that regulates our mood.
I've also read that hypoxia can help with depression. Are you seeing that being used here for that purpose?
From a physiological perspective, I just mentioned dopamine, the happiness hormone. It wipes out depression. When we change the environment, subjecting people to sub-stress levels of strain, the body produces dopamine, thus curing depression. This is how a patient is prepared for hypoxic therapy. During the procedure, the patient first breathes in a low oxygen mixture, then, after a certain interval, a high oxygen mixture. Roughly speaking, it's 10 minutes on low oxygenated air, followed by 10 minutes with high. Most importantly, we have to ensure the oxygen levels don't drop below a certain threshold. This protects the patient from serious distress. First, you are breathing a regular mixture with 21% oxygen. It's fallen now by 10%, so you're breathing a low oxygen mixture. You might find that you're having trouble breathing, but this sensation will go away after a while as you go through primary adaptation to low oxygen air. Now the real training has begun. The device is now supplying a mixture of 9.7% oxygen to your mask. The saturation level, or the amount of oxygen in your bloodstream, has dropped to 85%. 93% is the norm. During the next phase, when you're breathing regular air, your saturation should go up to 91 or 92%. These 15-minute cycles help train your body. It will take a total of 45 minutes.
Спасибо большое. Моя новая подружка Анна.
Да.
Вам. Спасибо большое.
Пожалуйста. Are you okay, Sean?
Да. It's interesting. It's very interesting, that's for sure. Now, I've heard you touch on this just a little bit. I want to kind of go back to this a little bit more. We've heard that cold can help you adapt. We've heard that stress can help you, your body adapt as well. We've heard that fasting can help your body adapt as well. So now, in basic terms, does it basically mean that in order for your body to really be functioning well, we need to put our bodies through stress in order for us to kind of have a balance?
Stress is an integral element of our life. We can't live without it. We may not always feel it, but it is necessary. And not only to be able to fully enjoy life's pleasures. Our systems need to be adapting all the time. The way nature created us means that our bodies are self-regulating systems, which seek to strike a certain balance. There is the medical concept of homeostasis, which is the state of balance within all physical systems in our body. We arrived at this mechanism through involution. Our body's systems are always prepared to support homeostasis. That's why stress is a necessary element in our lives. But let me say this again. The parameters, the qualities of this stress have to be within certain limits. Otherwise, blood vessels break. You can develop an illness. Your blood pressure rises, which is hard to manage. Or you have other conditions which will make your life difficult.
What diseases specifically are being treated here with hypoxia? And do you see this type of treatment growing in the future?
Treatment by hypoxic training relies, first and foremost, on the physiological mechanisms of treatment. This includes these adaptive processes. In practical terms, this means the treatment could work for any condition of a regulatory nature, or 99% of all disorders. We can't use it for cancer, of course. However, conditions which have to do with neural regulation, such as hypertension, blood vessel diseases, diabetes, depression, and light forms of mental disorders, can be treated. There's a wide range of applications.
Thank you very much for your time. It's been an incredibly interesting conversation.
That's all?
Yeah.